Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners, so let's be friends. We're dropping in midweek to update you on some things. So we're going to find out if there's been any movement in Felipe Massa becoming the rightful champion or whatever of 2008. And we'll also see where we think Andretti's bid is in the legal process and what might happen next. And we're going to lean on lawyer Peter Wright to help us with that. But first, Matt and I will be looking forward to the next race and asking, will Las Vegas F1 be rubbish or not? But first, let me remind you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. And joining me to decide whether Las Vegas is going to be rubbish or not, an American, Matt Trumpets. Hey, Matt.
I did not know Pirelli sold round popsicles.
Yeah, so it's going to be cold, man. So look, obviously you have the reputation as the guy who is obsessed with tyres. And this is the key thing to me, is that we are going to be running late at night with possibly single digit or close temperatures in the form of Celsius. So like 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 10 degrees Celsius, which is sort of unheard of, I think, in Formula One. So obviously I had to grab you for a bit of a Las Vegas preview, but we'll also be discussing why I'm not there, what the chances are of some decent racing, the track layout. Now we've both had a proper look at it, the time zones and all the rest of it. So why don't we start though, Matt? Let's fire into this track temperatures thing. Are the tires going to work?
Well, I hate to disappoint everybody, but outside of a very particular set of circumstances, most likely to be found at the very beginning of the race, yeah, they're going to work. And here's why. Everyone's been very focused on the actual temperatures in Las Vegas. Now, I've gone and looked at the forecast for Friday night, Saturday morning qualifying, and the following for the race. And it looks like mainly we're talking 12 to 14 C, which is 54 to 58 in freedom units. And while that is cold, we've actually had races that were colder, notably Nürburgring, the Eifel Grand Prix in 2020.
Right.
The ambient temperatures were 10 and the track temperatures were only 15 C. So we have seen cars working. And the thing to remember about this is everyone got focused on these very low temperatures and being at nighttime, but that track is going to be sitting out in the desert sunshine all day long, absorbing solar radiation. So the track will be warmer than the ambient temperatures. But even if it wasn't, remember, these tires live in tire warmers right up until they get chucked onto the car. 2 hours, 70 C, yet throw them on the car, out the car goes. they're not going to drop to ambient temperatures by the time they get to the end of the pit lane.
All right. But those two you mentioned, the Eiffel Grand Prix, where was that?
Yep.
Where was that?
That was in 2020 at the Nürburgring.
Right. Okay. So Nürburgring is the Grand Prix circuit. Is it quite front limited, if we talk about that? There's a lot of corners where you're under high load, long hairpins, lots of chicanes. So that might have given much more of an opportunity for the tyres to warm up. Now, we had a look at some onboards of the track layout, and like, wow, it is like the first sector of Baku twice with the big long straights. Nearly nothing where you're going to be leaning on the front tyres. So lots of traction zones, but where are they going to get temps into the front?
Well, obviously braking into the slow corners for the fast turns, the fast high speed turns. But I think it's worth noting that Pirelli has prescribed sort of unusually high pressures. I want to say like 24.5 and 27.5 by memory. I mean, these are like road car pressures. And the other thing to
wait. Why is that good or bad? Basically, you're saying to me these pressure stuff, and I see you having lots of conversations in our private WhatsApp with the other guys about, oh, the tire pressures have dropped. I can't believe it. And I'm like, it's been so long now that I was too afraid to ask. I'll do it here. I don't really know what that does.
Well, it essentially makes the tire stiffer so that there is less flex, especially in the sidewall. And the reason we see them this high, and it's the same reason why they're high at Silverstone, for example, that's why they even had to bring this new tire in, is that when you go through a high-speed turn, you're putting so much energy into that tire that if the pressures were low, the tire would flex and wobble a lot and potentially fail at the sidewall, in the construction, in other words.
Okay.
So Pirelli, in order to protect themselves, and to protect the drivers, because obviously the last thing you want is a tire failing at 300 kilometers an hour through a turn, is they run the pressures up to be sure that the tires will stay intact throughout the entire lap. Now, one of the side effects of that is it makes the amount of the tire that touches the road less, which means you're putting more energy into a smaller thing, which actually adds to the heat a little bit. But there are other tricks. But the thing that I want to point out, though, is really what springs to mind is, do you remember the race in Australia this year?
Yeah, the race of the many flags.
And at the end, they did a standing start. And the tires had gotten cold because they'd been sat in the pit lane for the red flag.
Yeah.
And they did the standing start, and everybody got to the first corner, and not everybody figured out how to stop the car on those cold tires. If there's going to be a problem that's not caused by a red flag, I fully expect the start to be where that happens, because the cars are going to go around pretty slowly and sit for a long time, and they're going to be heavy and full of fuel. The brakes are going to be cooling. The tires are going to be cooling. So really, the start of the race is, I think, where we see the most jeopardy based on tire temperature. I think once they get up and moving, they will be okay. And certainly coming out of the pits, they should have enough temperature left in the tires that they give enough grip to be safe.
So actually, Haas and Alfa Romeo have got a huge part to play here, because if they take a long time to take up their positions at the back of the grid, that's going to really affect the guys at the front. So finally, they can have an effect on the race. So I don't know. So you're being quite optimistic. They've said, okay, high tire pressure. What's the disadvantage of that? I guess is less grip, because
less contact patch. So less grip and less flexibility. So it is harder to work the tires a bit at the higher pressure.
So to me, that feels then like that's not going to help anything. When you talk about a cold track, so is this really dumb to say a colder temperature in general on the track will give you less grip or more grip? But less heat.
That's a real...
but less heat. So the tires won't work as well.
It makes it harder to keep the... At a certain point, it makes it hard to keep the tires in the window, especially, again, the other thing to look out for is if people try to run really long stints. As the rubber comes off the tire and sort of just mechanically being degraded by the asphalt, it gets harder to keep the core of the tire temperature up. And again, if you slip out of that zone, then suddenly where you normally brake for turn one, which will be the biggest problem after all those really long straights, you're going to brake there and you're going to turn and nothing's going to happen because the tires will not have enough temperature to grip in the manner you expect. And there's not a lot of forgiveness into turn one there. There's not a lot of runoff.
So there's a load of unknowns here. So we really won't know as we get into FP1 because it's a brand new track surface and that can go either way. So we got to Sochi when it first became a racetrack after the Olympics in Sochi. And they found that basically the surface didn't wear the tires at all. So they got to a point where Nico Rosberg, he pitted for Hards, I think, in that inaugural race after his lockup. So he pitted on the first lap and then did the rest of the race at the same pace as everybody else on his Hards, absolutely no problem, and finished second. So you don't really know until you get to it what kind of wear you're going to have. So there's much more than just the temperature. The track surface is going to play a big part.
Yeah, and I know a big chunk of it has been repaved for the Grand Prix.
What could go wrong?
unlike with the sprint races, they're going to have three full practice sessions here to understand what's going on. And even for the teams that struggle with tire warm-up, there's suspension tricks you can play. You can play with the amount of brake and rim heating that you use. All these things can be helpful to a greater or lesser extent dealing with it. That said, if they do fall out for any reason, either there's a red flag and they have to sit around a long time, or if you go for a super long stint, then we could see some issues. But on the whole, I don't think we're going to be I don't think we're looking at a track temperature of like 5°C.
No,
it's not going to be like at Barcelona when it snowed and no one could run because it was 0°C outside. It's not going to be that bad.
The forecast I saw for the race, so Saturday night in America, is something like 10 degrees Celsius, which is what, 40 Fahrenheit. And you go, well, in that case, I've always been told that you can't run in, say, the UK. You can't run in the UK in autumn because it would be, you know, far too cold. But it's 12 degrees Celsius today. So doesn't that just throw that argument out the window now? So now that we can go in Vegas in those kind of temperatures, why is the European season completely restricted to May, June, July, August?
I would add rain to that cold, and then that would probably
be why. You throw the rain in our face. Yeah, it has been pretty miserable today. And the thing is, like, we're used to the rain, but surely, you know, we want rain. So there you go. If you want a rainy Silverstone, if you want a rainy British Grand Prix, basically schedule it for October or November, and you're guaranteed misery. But instead, they do it on the one hot day of the year that Britain gets, so that everyone in the crowd sits there and absolutely cooks whilst drinking lager.
Yeah. And the other thing I should just add here is they are also bringing the softest of the compounds.
Good.
So you're going to have maximum help with the grip. I think what's unknown is running that super duper long straight. Some people may have issues with their fronts, but by the time we get to the race and even qualifying, they should have done enough running to understand the parameters they have to deal with, both the drivers and the teams.
All right. So there's one scenario where they get there, the track surface doesn't really have any abrasive effect on the tires, but yeah, it's a bit cold and slippy. So I think that's our worst case scenario for the race, is that there's no wear, so we don't get any tire strategy, but also the tires don't really work, so we get a lot of field spread. And I think this is my next big fear, is these are very challenging circumstances. And yes, you're right, they'll have three full practice sessions in order to come up to speed, but who is going to overcome those challenges better? It's going to be the top teams, isn't it? So Red Bull will do it a little bit better than Ferrari and Mercedes, who'll probably have a bit more time and a bit more success in overcoming that than Williams. So my fear is that overcoming all these problems, instead of just concentrating on the optimum performance on a sunny day in Silverstone, what you're going to have is massive field spread. So I'm going to make a prediction right now. I think Verstappen laps everyone except the podium places. He's gonna lap P4. That's my prediction.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Fields, that's not necessarily mine, but
no, but good. That's the worst case scenario for me is that the field spread makes it massively uncompetitive. So yes, you will be able to overtake on those long straights. I assume that is a DRS zone as well, that those straights are DRS zones, two DRS zones.
Yeah, there are two DRS zones, and I've seen speculation, because again, we're in a desert, we're at night, that it might actually be really easy for draggier teams to keep up with faster teams with the DRS, with the slipstream, might actually make things a bit easier. And also, like, the more mechanically minded of my friends have been talking about how the colder, denser air might affect the performance of the power unit. So we might see some interesting surprises there, but that's all. Oh. It's all a lot of speculation right
okay.
now.
Well, you've said, you know, if you said the opposite of those things, if you said thin air, then you'd go, ugh, the Mercedes struggle, because they struggle to get cooling in. So when you've got thin air, they struggle to get enough air to cool. Yeah. So while the opposite of
as
that
I
is...
I Google Las Vegas altitude for you. You keep talking.
Oh, so is it the opposite of Mexico? Is it very low? Is that what you're driving at? But yeah, so...
No, I don't think it's super low.
But if you have then a lot of dense air, that is the opposite of Mercedes kryptonite. And obviously Mercedes is one of the draggier packages out there as well. So also a big thing with Mercedes is, are they going to be able to run the ride height at the proper level to get the results that they had in Circuit of the Americas and at Mexico, where they were able to be kind of a front running team. Whereas in the last Grand Prix, they said, well, we didn't want to risk it, so we ended up with higher ride heights. So will the surface allow them to run low enough to get this ground effect working? Because they seem to have made a step forward with ground effect.
Yeah, I think that it will. I think a lot of the track has been surfaced, newly surfaced, and when they do that, they are pretty strict about how bumpy it is or how uniform it has to be. So that's going to be a help really to all the teams. And I think particularly for Mercedes, in Brazil, they were running into an issue where they were turning a lot, and the ride height they ran was making their downforce inconsistent because they are worse in the turns. And this goes back to the rear suspension and the side impact protection that we talked about, them being stuck with the zero pod design back there, basically. And so fundamentally somewhat compromised. Now, interesting, you've noticed how AlphaTauri has been doing better, right?
I'm triggered by the story because I've just found out why. So basically... Okay. You'll say better than me, but they've got all the rear suspension parts from Red Bull.
The RB19.
They just have them.
Last year's.
They just have them.
Now, what they did was they set up their car at the beginning of the year so they could put these parts on when they got to it. And having put those parts on, suddenly you can see how much farther up the grid they are. Contrast to Haas, who has Ferrari's rear end. And you can see that there is clearly something to the Red Bull rear suspension setup that is giving them a huge advantage in combination with the other aerodynamic parts they have screwed onto the car.
They should just do that all the time. They're the same team. There's not two completely separate and independent teams. They're the same team. Orders can go up and down between those teams. Personnel can be swapped between those teams. The drivers are loaned between those teams. They are one four-car team. So I'm surprised this doesn't happen more often. And in fact, for next season, they've already signaled that they're going to use a lot more of the Red Bull parts, a lot more in common.
They're basically moving to the Haas model with AlphaTauri, which, considering Red Bull is the team selling them all the bits, is going to be really good for whatever they're going to become next year. Because I think are they not ditching the name too?
Yep. Anyway. I think they're becoming Hugo Boss or something like that. I don't think we've heard quite yet. Okay, so I've always been surprised that they don't just do that more, because I've never understood, like, if you've got Yuki Tsunoda and you're lining him up to potentially be a Red Bull driver one day, don't you want him at the sharp end? Don't you want him fighting for higher points? And then when he does go to Red Bull, it's not such a big shock. But they've sort of let that team just meh its way through the last few seasons.
Yeah, I mean, because there are rules about who can move where and what they can talk about. And then also, you know, for sponsors and who knows what the corporate parents really want here. Maybe they wanted AlphaTauri to forge their own identity, or maybe their technical team really believed it was better for them to keep things simple. And rather than, like we saw with Aston, get completely lost when they borrowed the Mercedes concept.
Borrowed.
And they changed the rules a little bit. And Aston were like completely, okay, maybe not the first time that's happened, but
okay,
you get my point.
Actually, that was my first instinct. I'm like, oh yeah, well, Aston Martin copied Mercedes and they got pinged for it. Why aren't AlphaTauri being pinged for it? But I quickly guessed that, well, firstly, Aston Martin didn't ask, did they? They just sort of nicked it with the brake ducts and the green Mercedes or the pink Mercedes, wasn't it, when it was Racing Point? So that's them looking, like using laser scanners or looking at images and just trying to get inspiration from it.
A whole lot of stuff got banned after that.
Yeah. So this is more like a customer arrangement, which is completely legal and above board.
Yeah. You'd be happy to know that however else you might decide to impeach the FIA as a regulatory body, they have fairly straightforward standards as to things you have to either own the intellectual property of or design on your own, and things you can buy from other teams as suppliers. And there's been a move to allow the midfield teams to buy more stuff to reduce the field spread and make things more competitive.
I agree with that.
And that's not a problem. That's a good thing. But unless the team you're buying them from is Ferrari.
Yeah. So obviously you've still got the cost cap. So if you decide to buy a front wing that's for sale and build your concept around that, there's no real problem with that. Like what is to stop Williams saying to, you know, Mercedes, oh, you're...
Well, that you do have to design on your own.
The front wing, for definite.
Yeah, you couldn't buy Mercedes front wing, but you could buy their rear suspension. You could buy their gearbox.
Can you buy their side pods? I'd imagine they're going pretty cheap at the moment.
Well, I mean, they don't have them to sell,
exactly,
right?
Zero side pods. All right.
Zero pods,
So you've turned this into a tech time. I was trying to talk about Vegas.
No.
This is your fault. You've derailed this.
You just asked the question and I can't help it. It just naturally comes out. But I don't know. You want to talk about Vegas?
How did we get there?
What do you want to know? I've been there.
Have you?
Have you been there?
No. And I wanted to be there, and there was scope for us to do activities around
F1. I thought that was going to happen.
I said to you 50-50, and then that just kept coming down. And then I had a moment of hope that we could even, you know, get a proper like access and, you know, it'd be all expenses paid. But then that's fallen through as well. And I'm not going, but that's fine. That does give me the opportunity to go and hang out with Tomo F1 in his fancy studios in London. So me and Brad are going down there to do a live watch along starting at 5:30 a.m. And so I'll see if I can find the link to that stream, and you can watch along with me. And then I'll be doing their podcast. Then we'll do our podcast at midday. And then that means, Matt, that you are watching a Grand Prix in your home country that starts at 1 a.m. your time.
It might as well be in Australia, if I'm being honest.
But this is crazy. This is the crazy part to me. So obviously, like Las Vegas, it has to be at night, which is why we've got the cold temperatures. It has to be at night because Las Vegas is your equivalent of Blackpool, which you won't know. You won't have heard of Blackpool Illuminations.
I have.
So that's the thing that dads say. And I even said it the other day. I went upstairs and every single bedroom had the light on. And I went, hey, it looks like Blackpool Illuminations up here. Sorry, Dad. And then I went from room to room. They went to run up the stairs. I'm like, no, I'll do it. I went to room, turning off lights and tutting loudly and complaining. So that's your Las Vegas.
What
is
a life's joys.
It's your version of Blackpool. And it's all about the illuminations, the flashing lights, the neon. You've got that wonderful sphere thing with that you can put any of the graphics on. What's that called?
Yeah.
Is it called the sphere?
The sphere.
I think it's called the sphere. And I love it when it's got a big smiley face that watches trains and like watches planes. It's really freaky. And apparently F1 have control of that for the race as well. So it will primarily be used for advertising. But that's what they're going for. It has to be at night, so that it can be illuminated. But the
outside of Monaco, like Singapore, like all these races they like the night races because they look good on TV.
Yeah, so it's a destination Grand Prix. It looks good on TV, but you could also have it a little earlier if you wanted to not have it quite as cold. So, but the reason you can't do that is because F1, as American owned and as American centric, the drive for new viewers has become, they are still not stupid enough to put on that race when Europeans are asleep. So if you did it a few hours earlier, so that you would, it would be a 10 p.m. race for you, and it would be a 7 evening race in Las Vegas still, it would be 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning for us. So, you know, for Britain at the moment, it's 6 a.m. For mainland Europe, it is 7 a.m. So they still will not have it while we are sleeping. So that I think that's quite telling. And that's how they seem to have got themselves in this fudge where, yes, it's at night, tick, but the people in their own country on the East Coast are asleep. But it does mean that the Europeans can set an alarm at a somewhat civilized time. It's a real fudge how they've got to that point.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's a bit of a move, because that's not an unusual time for, like, say, a college football game out west to be on, or a basketball game. I think they're trying to capture a different sports market in that part of the country. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what they're up to with this and whether or not it will continue to happen at exactly this time. But I watch enough of them. You know, Australia is bad. Japan, same thing. I mean, bad from an East Coast point of view, time-wise, not bad in terms of the racing, because that's pretty good, at least at Japan, it usually is.
So if it was boxing, they would have no problem just having it at whatever time, for, and it wouldn't matter that the Europeans were asleep or had to stay up until 2 in the morning. But F1, it still shows, you know, they're not willing to write us off just yet. We're still somewhat of a factor in the TV schedule.
Yeah. Although I don't know, like you mentioned boxing, it wouldn't be surprising for like a championship bout to start pretty late. And I know, like, things like MMA oftentimes will go late if the big bout will be on pretty late at night. So if you're watching it, even on the East Coast, it might be an 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock start. So we're not too far off of that. And I think maybe that's the vibe they're going for, because it is in Vegas, where you have the championship heavyweight boxing fights for so many years. I think they're trying to sort of get that same excitement to the people that come to see it in person, however many that's going to be. Oh. And then obviously for the people watching it, they want to generate that same, all right, we've seen, you know, there's no preliminaries, but, you know, like the buildup will be the same across the weekend. And then you have the big championship bout Saturday night. And that's kind of exciting.
So that's an interesting thing that you bring up there. How many people are actually going to go and see this? So I wanted to get out there. And like I said, there was some half opportunities for us to go and do stuff. Some of, they've all fallen through, so it's fine.
Yeah.
But the best one would be, obviously, for us to be paid to go out there and do stuff, which nearly did happen. The second best option would be to get out there economically and then be able to take opportunities once we're already out there. For example, there was a podcast studio that I was talking to. And you go, okay, for how high profile this whole event is, I was looking at it as a business investment. And actually, the flights, which I assumed would be very expensive, say, weighed in, I could get there for like 400 quid. I would have to stop in Alaska somewhere, you know, and it was a total of 24 hours to get there. But that's fine. I don't mind traveling. And hotel rooms were completely standard price. So looking at, you could Airbnb or hotel for about $100 a night. That wasn't a massive deal either. But the tickets were still in excess of $1,000. So like £1,200, I think, was the 3-day pass. And there's no point going all the way there if you're not going to see cars. But then we're hearing reports that ticket sales are incredibly low. So I haven't got anything concrete. There was a newspaper article from the circuit representatives that were saying, we're expecting it to be sold out. But then we're hearing other people saying, now we've been told that sales are just in the bin at like 10%, 20%. Like, even if they didn't sell 50%, that would surely be considered a failure. But what would be more annoying is to see empty seats in that grandstand when I would have paid a few hundred quid, which to me feels like a very reasonable price to go and watch a Grand Prix. You know, the first Silverstone weekend I attended, one of the most popular Grand Prix in the world, it was £300 for a three-day general admission ticket. To look at like 1,200 quid, like obviously no. I don't know who's paying those prices, but like obviously no. And that feels like a fail if there's empty grandstand seats. So I don't know what that's doing for the city. They've blocked out views from everyone who isn't deliberately going there. So no one's going to accidentally see the Formula One. You're going to have to, on purpose, spend 1,200 quid or $1,200 to go and see that event. Now, if the NFL came to Colchester, where I live, and played at our local stadium, but charged me £1,000, like, I wouldn't go. I go, there's an event that costs £1,000. I'm not going. So I really don't understand the pricing or bringing it to a city if it's closed off to everyone except people who would casually pay £1,200 to try a new thing.
Well, I think, first of all, there are probably more people who will do that than you think there are.
Where are they? Eat them. Eat those people.
Well, please send us your money.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/MissedApex.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
And you're welcome.
We've had some new patrons this week as well. And it's been very nice to see because it makes me and Matt breathe in and out a little bit less heavy because we know that we can prioritize Missed Apex over other work. Thank you. But yeah, sorry. I went off on a rant there. Because
I was just going to go. I would be surprised to see any empty grandstands.
Really?
I suspect.
Okay.
Well, it's they have this thing, surge pricing. Maybe if you've ever taken an Uber or Lyft at rush hour in the rain when it's cold, you've noticed that your 10-block trip costs you $7,000. But if you happen to be taking that trip in the middle of the day when it's sunny, it costs you $10. Well, I think they wanted to sell based on exclusivity. And it may be that all the super duper VIP stuff, like, I mean, they were like $50,000 packages being offered by hotels. Probably all of that is sold out because anyone who has the kind of money to say, yes, I can afford that, is really not worried about spending that kind of money in any event. And it's a new thing and they'll probably want to be there. But what I will expect to happen is as we get closer to the event, I would expect those ticket prices to drop and or eventually people just to be let in for free to see it if they're really that desperate to get people in. I don't think they will be. Where they might be losing out is I think it's a thing certain operators will buy tickets and then offer packages based on those tickets. So like, yeah. You know, the Aston team might offer a super exclusive VIP package. But most of the people who buy that might spend a little bit more money and do the super fancy thing. Or there'll be people who don't have enough money to do that and would never consider it. So it may be there's some mid-level operators that are getting a little bit hammered right now. And if you happen to be one of those and would like to offer me VIP access.
Feedback at missedapex.net. Just
email us. Absolutely. I will pick up a plane ticket, rent myself a hotel room, and I'll come out and say, and I will point out that I'm a minor celebrity now in the Formula One world, and at least tens of people know me.
Yeah, tens of people might know me. You have some followers.
I would happily come and terrify your guest talking about tire construction.
Okay, Matt's personal business advert aside. No, I was just annoyed because I was trying to go a third of the way across the world to get in. So and the price is ridiculous. So it had better be full Las Vegas. Anyway, so do we think that this Grand Prix will be good? Okay, we did kind of the worst case scenario with the field spread earlier, which is personally what I think is going to happen. I think teams are going to struggle to get their setups and to get pace, and we're going to see a long chain of spread out cars by the third or fourth lap. What's the best case scenario? Like, how can this race be good? Because the only defense so far I have seen for this track. Is, well, Singapore's at night on a street circuit. Are you saying Singapore's rubbish? Yeah, kinda. But we always accepted that Singapore was rubbish because it was like the one race that was kind of like that. Okay, it's at night. It's a city destination. We get it. We'll tolerate it. Yeah, all right, we'll tolerate Monaco earlier in the season. We all know that's rubbish, but okay, I know. You have to gaslight us into saying you have to be there. Okay, fine. That's the two, wasn't it? And then Baku was introduced, and they had one, I think the first race had a brilliantly timed safety car. There was a well-timed red flag in 2021. But without those things, that is not a good circuit to go racing on. But the defences I've seen are, yeah, well, are Singapore and Baku rubbish then? Yes, they are. So, I don't know, we're going to judge Las Vegas as a street circuit. Like, you and I will judge it as a street circuit, whereas I don't think the general F1 population has had their expectations managed for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy to say this is going to be an interesting Grand Prix to watch. Mm. Never raced there before. We have weird environmental challenges.
Yeah.
It's at a bizarre time. And they're interesting parameters to sort of be watched and looked over. And there will be discussions, fun discussions to come out of it. Will it be good? Well, no, of course not. Max is going to win and everybody knows it. What would make it good? Oh, pretty simple. Come out of the pit lane. Max spins up the rear tires, goes spinning off into, I don't know, pick your favorite other driver that you like to see not finish the race. We get a red flag and everybody restarts with half the race left on very cold tires. And it's a nail biter to the finish between three or four different manufacturers, including maybe a midfield team. Who knows? Haas might do well here. The other thing I do want to point out is I think they're talking about around 350 kilometers per hour top speeds here. So if you were there in person and saw a car going that fast,
all right,
it would be pretty exciting, regardless of who was doing what in the rest of the race.
I was trying to be there. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to see F1 cars going super duper fast. And there is really nothing quite like watching F1 cars just absolutely bomb by you. And you get that same, that experience is very hard to replicate. So when I think about whether I'm, say, going to go to Silverstone or not, there is a genuine toss-up between the experience of being there and, say, watching the rear end of Formula One cars going through Maggots and Becketts and watching that direction change as if by magic, even at slower speeds through the first section around the loop as it flicks onto the Wellington Straight. It's unbelievable. It's like they're just spinning in motion. It's like they get to the end of the loop and just spin and then go down to, go like they're on a railway turntable. So yeah, there's that kind of thing of going, right, do I want that experience of seeing it? It's incredible to see it. And actually WEC is way up there. If you get a chance to go and see World Endurance Championship cars, like watching those and the support series cars going past you on track is an incredible experience. It's completely different though from actually watching the race. And one of the things that puts me off from ever actually attending Grand Prix is that, like, I was at the 2013 Grand Prix and I really didn't have much idea about what was going on outside of Sector 1. And I was disappointed that I kept missing moves that were happening down at Stowe. So it's a completely different experience. It's a completely different sport, if you like. So I don't want to miss the race. So whenever I look at the tickets, I'm like, right, I want to see Friday and Saturday. So that's one thing. You go, okay, well, the experience of watching F1 cars at this hypothetical maximum speed, that's fine, but that isn't going to change the TV experience at all. In fact, if anything, it's just going to change the sound of the onboard from me to me as it runs out of power at the end of the straight. That's my best V6 hybrid impression.
I like that. I think that's the next set of regulations we're really worried about, though. The good news with the MGUH is it's going to keep that battery nice and charged up and plenty of energy headed off to the ancillary systems.
Where are you going to charge your battery around this track?
The MGUH can send electrical energy directly to various systems. So because you're running high in the revs for long periods of time, the MGUH is basically making free energy for the rest of the car. You can only put so much of it into your battery.
Do you know what? I'm thinking of
MGUK. You can send it other places for free.
So I'm thinking of the MGUK, aren't I? Where the kinetic battery, where you recover energy from braking.
And that is the discussion about the next power unit regulations and whether or not there will be enough regeneration possible to create the amount of energy they want to use electrically, or whether or not they're going to have to parasitically run the internal combustion engine to charge up the battery a little bit on the straights.
Well, it's going
to
be it's going to be sustainable fuels, though, isn't it? So I've been led to believe that that is all going to be from crushing guinea pigs through a blender, and and there's so many guinea pigs that we'll be fine.
Yeah, you know, WEC actually uses discarded grapes from winemaking for their fuel now.
Is it?
Yeah, really? It's 100%. Yeah, drop in, same energy density.
Is that fuel that could have been wine?
No, it's leftover after the winemaking.
Okay, that's fine.
Although I've had some wine that has tasted like fuel, it didn't come from France.
So the best case scenario is drama, and that's.
Yeah.
But that's a problem, though, isn't it? So, I mean, that's the same in Miami. And have we had a good race in Miami? No. Are most of the races in Baku any good? No. Do we get any good Singapore Grand Prix? Just that one where it was made good because Russell and Hamilton couldn't overtake Sainz. But generally, no, that's always a dud. So what we're hoping for is, and this puts us in a very, you know, a bracket of fans that we wouldn't normally want to associate with. No, enjoy what you want to enjoy. But there are people who are there for the crashes and the drama. But I think that's all we've got. That's all we've got, I think, for this.
I don't know. I think you've got Williams. Genuinely, this is a track that could really super duper work for them. Obviously, and much to your utter annoyance, you've got AlphaTauri with the potential with their updated aerodynamics.
Come on, Yuki.
To be, I mean, they're in a pretty serious battle, weren't they, for like eighth place with Alfa Romeo? Like
that doesn't matter.
There's not nothing at stake here.
No, that doesn't matter. The battle is Tsunoda versus Ricciardo. That is the battle for the soul of the Red Bull succession line.
Yes, and so I mean, and you know, there's always the perennial "how will Perez do at this track?" question to be answered.
I don't want to play.
Which he's been doing better. I think he's. I, you know, the funniest thing to me, like I'm going to completely derail this whole show here.
That's fine.
Is you gave me so much grief for talking about how and Brad did too, but Brad just gives everybody grief, so I just ignore that. But genuinely, if you have been where Perez was. With as terrible as his performance was, and knowing that everything is on the line every time you walk on the track, to see him come back just to where he has is actually a really, as a performer, I find that very impressive because mentally it's hard to do. Like once you're lost and you have to go out in front of the audience and you're going out there saying, I have no idea what's going to happen when I try to do this thing, and to go out there and to be able to get back to even a respectable level of performance in the race, you know, I mean, like Alonso showed him up a little bit, but that's Alonso
in a
too.
Much
I mean, come
slower
on,
car.
It's not like nobody, and qualifying was never really his thing anyway. I do genuinely feel like he's made progress with this car, and I'm sort of interested to see if he can get closer in qualifying now, because if they figured out how to work with him. And the car, they should continue to be able to extract more performance from it in qualifying. And that's the unanswered question right now.
There's a movie, an American movie about baseball. And I can't remember what it's called. And I can't remember who is in
it. Hit the thing with the stick.
And it's about 30 years old as well. But it was about a one-armed batter, right? Okay. He had one arm and it was his bad arm. And the story was, he lost it as a kid. And then he... But he still managed to just about get into a majors team. Is that the thing? Yeah. Anyway, so he started off, hit a few home runs, and it was going quite well. And then it started going badly, as all movies do. And it was going so badly that he kept not hitting it. And then at one game, he hit it. It went into the ground, and he ran to first base. And his fan base went absolutely crazy. They're like, yes, finally. You know, he got a ball hit. And then the coach turned around and said to the family, I think, they said, the fact that you're celebrating him getting to first base shows that it's over. And that's the feeling I get with Perez. So you're celebrating him going onto first base. Me as a Perez fan, I'm going, we shouldn't. Sorry. The fact that we're celebrating
Brazil was more than first base. That's my argument.
He got Brazil beaten was more than to the podium.
Yeah, by... Was it the one before? I could see your point. Like, whatever. He finished in the top 10. Yay. But Brazil fighting for a podium with Alonso and like genuinely fighting with him. And then Aston that clearly had a lot of performance. No, and coming from as far back as he did, which is, I know that's your first base. He came back from so far, but yeah. His qualifying was always okay. Suspect. But I see the race performances coming back. And to recover that after you've lost it, it's like a golfer who has the yips and then gets a new putter and then figures out how to putt again and is competitive again. I think it's a more impressive story. But I also understand you don't want to give yourself any hope. So fair enough.
So Verstappen,
I'll allow you that interpretation.
Verstappen's out there getting birdies if we're going to do golf. He's out there getting birdies, yeah. And what
he's playing with a 7-iron and a driver and shooting 10 under par. Yeah, it's
but
ridiculous.
What we're saying is that Perez is shanking it off the tee every time and putting it out of bounds, getting penalty strokes, but then we're celebrating that he gets onto the green and two putts and gets, you know.
Yeah.
And, but it's still a double bogey. So you're still celebrating.
If you've ever had
bogey.
The shanks, you would understand what an impressive achievement that is.
Pretty much, I dream of the shanks. That's a level I can aspire to. At least I'm making contact with the ball. Okay, but I think in general, I do get annoyed with this comeback drive narrative week in, week out in Formula One. The driver that gets celebrated the most seems to be the driver that qualifies out of position and then does some overtakes. And in fact, there was a period, it hasn't come up much lately, where Lance Stroll kept getting lauded for having the most overtakes or the most
Didn't
positions.
Did he call it like the worst qualifier award for a while on our
but
show?
It was, he kept, yeah, but he's gained the most places than anybody else on lap one. Yeah,
worst qualifier.
Of course, because he's fighting cars that are like, you know, right down at the bottom of the championship.
Yeah, you're Flintstoning it at the start.
It should have been people saying, look, that just shows how bad his qualifying was. But it wasn't. It was celebrated as, see, he can race and overtake and stuff like that. But it happens all the time. Perez has had so many Driver of the Day awards from basically messing up Saturdays. So just as a rule, can we not do that? And if you're listening to my voice, can you join forces with me and Meg Schuster from The Ringer, a show I do as well? And we would like to all vote for Latifi as Driver of the Day in Las Vegas. Whatever happens, I'm going to get on there. I would like to throw the weight of Missed Apex and The Ringer and give Latifi something to celebrate at a home race. Are you in, Matt? Are you voting? Did I just say Latifi?
He's not driving anymore.
Sergeant. I clearly meant Logan Sargent.
I was wondering, like, if they left this hole where you can just, like, write in a driver, and that would be hilarious, because I would totally be behind
it. So I clearly meant Logan Sargent, but I said Latifi about five times.
I was kind of confused.
No, but
I thought you might have meant Sergeant there, but...
But that's a bit of a Freudian slip, isn't it? Because basically every conversation we've had about Sergeant has been nearly exactly the same copy and paste that we were having about Latifi. But yeah, let's do Sarge Tifi, Driver of the Day in the Las Vegas Grand Prix. Let's make it happen.
Maybe he'll score another point.
Yeah, wow. Okay, good. All right, well, I'm looking forward to Las Vegas, more with curiosity. It is something different. The best case scenario is drama, I think, but there could be plenty of drama. You could see teams really struggle in practice, even to get the rear end to stick. So that's a prediction I'll make. FP1, you're going to see cars snaking out of the traction zones, and not every team is going to be able to overcome that. So I think the whole journey from Friday practice to the race on Sunday, hopefully that can be quite fascinating. I would say there's a high possibility that this is a one-stop race where everyone gets through turn one clearly and there's field spread. And that happens at races like Baku and Singapore. So maybe just manage your expectations. I think there's too many races on the calendar where we have to do this now, with Miami also on the calendar and Monaco obviously as well. So it's another race where we're going to have to manage expectations. And if we get a little sprinkling of drama, then so be it. So earlier today, me and Matt caught up with Peter Wright, who's a real lawyer, Matt, and he's a very nice man, and he understands the law and stuff, and also does research, which isn't really in the Missed Apex spirit, but man, does he know his stuff and compile good arguments and insights.
Yeah, he is the guy you want to talk to because he loves Formula One and he also knows things.
All right, so let's have that conversation. Now we're going to talk about things like Andretti and Felipe Massa. We'll see you on Sunday. I already said that. I've forgotten what I've said in the previous pre-record. So I'll just say it twice. I'll see you on Sunday. And then later, I'll say see you on Sunday again. Bye. No, can't say bye. We're going into a segment. Oh, it's a disaster. I'll do another breaker and then here's the segment.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Now then, from the glamour of Vegas to the equally glamorous world of politics and law, and the person that we call upon when we need to know what's going on in the political machinations of Formula One is Peter Wright from Digital Law. No longer Digital Law UK, just Digital Law, because you're now international legal superstars. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Spanners, and hello, everyone. And yeah, we've gone global now. So yeah, we dropped the UK bit.
Nice. So you're going to bring us some updates on stories that have been bubbling under the surface. We want to talk about some Andretti news. But I think the thing that's been most prevalent since Brazil was the appearance of future Brazilian president, probably, Felipe Massa. How is his case going? Because the last I heard, he'd sort of issued an ultimatum to the FIA, like, you had better make a decision by sometime. And I think that time seems to have come and gone.
Indeed. Well, at time of recording, the date that is in question is the 15th of November. So,
ooh, that's tomorrow.
It is imminently.
Have we chosen exactly the wrong day to record this? And by tomorrow, they're going to declare him the 2008 champion.
Well, I'd say this is the right time to be having a conversation about this, because I can hopefully give you and all the listeners a little bit of background on exactly what a lot of the public pronouncements that have been made on this so far actually mean. And the thing that we're going to get tomorrow is a little bit of sort of put up or shut up. We'll be finding out, are they actually going to do something about this, as in, is Massa's legal team going to get serious? Or is there going to be a sort of gently walking away, disappearing into the hedge, hoping that no one notices a lot of the noise that happens?
Oh, nice. I understand that reference. That is a Homer Simpsons reference. Yeah, so, first of all, let's take a guess. Will he be declared 2008 champion?
Well, I'll take you back to my previous answer when you asked me that. And the last time I was on, I said, questions to which the answer is no. Yeah. I mean, looking at this at a fairly rudimentary level, first of all, we've got to look at any potential claim that Massa has got. And I say potential because that's literally where this is. They have sent a letter to the FIA threatening to take them to court using the courts in England and Wales. So, you know, they've basically said, we're going to sue you in London, potentially in the High Court, because it would be a major piece of litigation. But we haven't got to the point of saying we're actually going to issue legal proceedings to go to court. So all we have is what they call a letter before action, a letter before claim. That's what they've put in, basically saying, we think we've got a case here and we want you to start negotiating with us. We want you to start confirming what evidence you've got to defend the allegations that we are making with regards to Crashgate 2008 and the whys and the wherefores of that. But as I say, at the moment, all we've got is a letter. So we've not had any litigation. We haven't seen what real evidence Massa has, apart from that interview that's been quoted that Bernie Eccleston gave. And we certainly don't know what formally the FIA's position would be in defending this, because they do not have to publicly issue anything as yet. It's a letter that's been said. And I think we just have to think, well, what do we have currently in the public domain? And a disclaimer here, I'm not privy to any, you know, illegal machinations that might be taking place. I've not seen any letters or any other things there. I am merely just talking about this in the same way that everyone out there has seen different articles and different publicly available sources.
Well, I immediately have a question. And you just mentioned the FIA, and it occurred to me, I thought I had seen people interviewing Dominic Colley about this. Has Massa sent this letter to Liberty FOM and not to the FIA? Or has this been sent to both parties? Do you know?
So everything I've seen, and again, I'm just going from what's quoted in publicly available articles, they have referred to the FIA. And I presume that's because the remedy he's looking for is, I want the Singapore Grand Prix 2008 to be, in effect, expunged from the record books, and that then, in theory, reapportioning of points from that, or taking away the points that were scored there, would then have an impact on the final 2008 championship table. That's what he's alleging, based on the statements that were made around, you know, we subsequently found out that, you know, Crashgate, there were decisions made with regards to a driver deliberately driving into a wall. But at the moment, the results from that race stand. The precedent, of course, is not there, because never in the entire history of the Formula One World Championship have we had a race result annulled.
So there's obviously plenty of examples of some laps being voided, where or teams being disqualified. So there are a number of kind of face-saving options the FIA could take if they so wished. So they could just go, do you know what? You're absolutely right. It's a disgrace that previous administration didn't take immediate action. We will take action now and disqualify Renault. And we apologize that wasn't done earlier. And of course, that doesn't affect anything.
But this is what I mean by, what's your evidence? Because the question at the moment is, why would you? What reason would the FIA have for taking such an extraordinary step? The only evidence we have is, an interview that Bernie Eccleston gave. And he doesn't have the greatest record in terms of being a reliable witness when it comes to saying things.
Allegedly. Hang on. You're the one who always says to me, we have to say he's allegedly an unreliable witness. I personally think he's brilliant, probably. Okay. That was Peter Wright from Digital Law making. That was the voice you just heard.
Just to keep him clear, as an American, I'm going to say, I believe at this point he has an actual record in court, not just an alleged record based on our observations.
So very, very briefly, Bernie Eccleston pled guilty to fraud by false representation. That's paid $652 million to HMRC, which is the tax authorities in the UK, with regards to a trust based in the Far East that he neglected to tell the tax authorities about in the UK. So when I'm saying he's not necessarily a reliable witness, that's what I'm referring to.
Well, I think he owned up to it, so that's all right. That's what I think. I'm still Team Eccleston here in general. So we're not talking about Bernie Eccleston, though, are we, Peter?
No.
What the listeners who aren't on YouTube won't see is that you are currently in a house and most of the ornaments are solid gold, and you actually drive a solid gold diamond-encrusted car. The windscreen is diamond-encrusted because lawyers are very, very wealthy individuals that cost a lot. When do the legal costs start becoming a problem for Massa? Like, I don't know how wealthy he is, but, you know, could he afford to call up Peter Wright and add another diamond to your gold-plated Lexus. I don't even know if Lexus is an expensive car. I took a punt. I took a street rat punt.
Well, okay.
Well, I've thrown you a little.
I'll just draw a veil over the whole what you were saying about all lawyers earning a lot. I can tell you for a fact they don't. And certainly, certainly have not a golden crusted car. But I think and I'll also not go into detail on Lexus because you don't tend to see so many Lexi on the road anymore.
Right? No. Yeah, I think I have thrown you off topic. But yeah. when are the legal costs going to start kicking in? Because there's a point where you go, all right, it's all talk at the moment. We had months and months of talk. Unless you do something, frankly, his credibility and his reputation is in the dirt at the moment. I think if we take a popular poll of how people feel about Felipe Massa at the moment, it's less good than it was before.
Indeed. So the legal costs only will become an issue once legal proceedings are filed. So at the moment, where we've got what this we call this pre-action phase that we're in of letters being sent back and forth, costs do not start to get incurred. What do we mean by costs? Whenever you hear of a big piece of litigation, so for example, you know, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard last year, you had legal costs involved, and it runs into millions of pounds or dollars or whatever currency you're looking at because of all the very expensive people who are in the room. And not to mention the length of time that it usually takes before you actually get into a courtroom. Very often this litigious process will run for a long time. But at the moment, let's say we have not got legal proceedings. What do I mean by that? Legal proceedings start when a party goes to court and issues a claim, files a claim form that says, I have a claim. You know, I, Felipe Massa, have a claim that I should have been world champion in 2008, and I'm very upset about it. And this is the basis for my claim. Here is the court fee that I am going to pay for this. And you have to pay a fee based on the sum at issue. Now, if you're claiming more than four or five figures, that amount will be large. And it's almost like saying, I'm serious, therefore I'm going to pay a couple of £1,000 on a court fee. And that's just the court fee that you're paying the court to lodge that piece of paper to say, I have a case.
Didn't you say that apart from having the championship robbed, he was talking about the immeasurable amount of money that it has cost me in lost promotion and career stuff. So, but in future conversations, like anything I heard from him in Brazil, he seems to have dropped that and really focused in on the, I had my championship stolen.
And I think that probably suggests that he has difficulty in accurately saying, well, this is the position I would be in if I had actually won the world championship in 2008. You know, you can point to Jenson Button and say, oh, look, Jenson won one title the year after, and he's now doing this and that and the other. But of course, Jenson was had a very different career both before and after his world championship and has gone in a different direction. So you can't really compare apples and oranges, can you? So I think that might be the reason why he's moved away from that line of saying, well, this is what I'm after, and he's going more towards saying, I want the world championship. But the thing here is that even to get to the point of drafting that form, he wouldn't write that himself. He would instruct his very expensive lawyers, his global legal team, which he referred to previously, and you know they would be drafting that form and in theory putting together witness statements by Massa saying, this is how I've been impacted by this. This is how unfair it was, blah, blah, blah. Supporting witness evidence, documentary evidence, probably sitting down and getting a detailed statement from Bernie Eccleston. That's not going to come cheap, is it? So you can quickly see where all of the costs would start to escalate in a massive way. Even just Felipe Massa's costs in putting this case together. Before you then look at the FIA incurring a huge amount of cost to defend said claim. So that would all begin to snowball, particularly over the long period of time this would take.
So I'm immediately, from an American litigation point of view, curious if he were to bring this claim and it were to be litigated and thrown out in certain cases in the U.S. as a plaintiff bringing a case that had no merit, ultimately, you might be found liable for the expenses of the defendant. So is it the case that if he does pay his money and take his chances, so to speak, because we are going to Vegas after all, that he might be on the hook to pay not just his own, I'm assuming, fairly massive legal fees, if we're going to grant that there's not somebody in the background bankrolling this, because that's something that's possible in the U.S. too. Is it possible then that he could be on the hook for both sides of this legal action should it come to court?
Yes. If it got as far as going to court, and if he were then to lose, and even then, if you lose, you don't necessarily end up paying the other side's costs. That is a decision that the judge would take, and that would be dependent on the conduct of the parties and various other issues that will be taken into account. But I think it's also worth mentioning here that even to actually get to the point of having the day in court, we'd be talking about that being years from now. We've currently got a delay in the courts, that which you had courts in the UK were slow anyway. Then we had the pandemic. So it would take years for this to get in front of a judge, and it would be a complex case anyway. So I think you'd be looking at a good 3-4 years to get there.
So I think we're close to being done with kind of an update on this, because we're still awaiting this decision that's meant to be, you know, the 15th of November deadline.
Yes.
Is there anything the FIA could answer that would just kill this? So could the FIA turn around and go, do you know what? We've judged it and we are going to cancel the Singapore Grand Prix. I know there's no precedence, but we've just decided to do that to make this go away. Like, is that a technical possibility?
No.
Oh, why?
I don't think they'd end up doing that just based on threats that have been made in correspondence.
Right.
At the moment, in that letter, basically Massa and his legal team will have said, we want disclosure. We want to know what you knew about that race in 2008. We want to see the reports from the stewards. We want to see even emails and WhatsApp messages or SMSs that were exchanged at the time. Probably wasn't even WhatsApp in 2008 after all, but they'd want a lot of contemporaneous evidence, because at the moment, you know, they're sort of saying, look, we've got this issue, but we need disclosure from you. We need all of this evidence actually for us to make our claim. So it's a bit of what we call a fishing expedition. They're wanting to get evidence from the FIA and FOM so they can then look at thinking, well, will we go ahead and actually make a claim or not? The chances of the FIA turning around and saying, you've sent that letter and go, you're absolutely right, we'll give you that. I just don't see it happening.
Okay. No, fair enough. So the likely outcome is that FIA are going to say, okay, no, we're not going to take any action. Please proceed with whatever it is that you're going to do. And so this is now going to... So once that deadline passes and they go, nah, that's it. We're on this 3-year roller coaster and it becomes the least interesting topic ever, apart from we're going to have to hear from Massa every Brazilian Grand Prix talking about it. Yeah. So that's the most likely outcome. Great. Well, I mean, I'm glad we got the update, Peter, but it isn't the most thrilling. Actually, my God.
I do have one question for you more. The thing that is that I'm wondering most about, although, again, like as you say, if this is mostly going to be a fishing expedition, they're hoping to get to discovery and find something that's more of a smoking gun that might work for them. And even then, if you look at how normally, like you say, oh, well, we'll throw them out of the championship, it doesn't change. The only way that I recall the result really changes is if you basically give Felipe Massa the position he was running in before his car caught fire in the pit lane. And I don't know why they would do that, because the whole rest of the race happened after that crash. But aside from that, in the FIA boilerplate, there is set out a court of appeals that you can go to as long as you present new evidence. And fundamentally, it would seem to me that this statement from Bernie Eccleston that he since has disavowed would technically be that. Is it reasonable? Or why is it that they think that a court in England will simply ignore the process already set out for him to start on from a legal point of view, questioning stewards' decisions, and just say, oh, well, yeah, you did sign that agreement as a participant, but we're going to ignore it and just let you come to our court and we'll adjudicate it here?
I think you're quite right. There would be that issue on jurisdiction. There is also an argument, don't forget here, on the sheer length of time. Certainly with regards to the law in England and Wales, you have something called limitation. if you were trying to sue some on something 6 years after that happened in relation to anything over, say, a contract or an incident, your statute barred, your time bound. You can't turn around 10, 15, 20 years later. You can apply to the court and say, I want you to consider this. But the judge has to think, well, actually, there's a real good reason why we should disapply what the law says with regards to limitation. There is probably a similar thing with regards to what's in the FIA statutes there, Matt, as well. And that could actually dictate the reason why he's coming to the court, the High Court, because he knows full well that limitation means he simply can't do it there. And I think that's part and parcel of what we're dealing with here. Even before you get near that three-year process, I say limitation would come to play. That could take you 2 years to sort that out.
Well, I can't wait to watch this slowly unfold. But I think it's great to get that update, because I think the update is that this is as a story is pretty much dead from an interest point of view. And at some point in 2028, it's not your fault that that's the case. And I appreciate the update. I'm not like, no, Peter, why did you bother? Because I think people got this feeling like something's going to happen imminently. And what you've done is you've managed our expectations for that. It didn't come out like that. It came out like, thanks a bunch, Righty. That's what it came out as. I accept that. All right, let's move on to something that is realistic and might happen slightly sooner. That's my breaking news sound. As Matt, you brought me some breaking news via Chris Medland's Twitter account, which is where most news comes from.
Well, that's where all news comes from for those in the know. But it turns out that I think in the raising the stakes department, GM has officially applied to be a power unit manufacturer as of 2028, saying they plan to partner with, you guessed it, Andretti. So it's just one more, because we've also heard, you know, that maybe there had been some approaches to GM. Gee, wouldn't you really rather work with one of our other teams that already exists and not this silly Andretti startup that will probably be crap anyway? We don't know the truth of those exactly, but certainly those rumors were floating around. So it just seems like the latest in what to me is an incomprehensible saga of there's no really good reason to say no, other than the current teams are just being, well, toddlers about it, if I'm being honest.
Okay, so just to get our facts straight here, because that is the next topic that Peter's going to be bringing us insight into is basically Andretti's bid to join Formula One. So Chris Medland says, breaking, General Motors say it has registered with the FIA to be an F1 power unit manufacturer from 2028 onwards. Andretti Cadillac would be powered by GM power units should it be successful with its F1 entry. Now, that doesn't say the FIA have completely approved it or they've started building it. All they're saying is that they've registered to be an F1 power unit. That could be filling a form in. So I'm not hearing anything from the FIA rubber stamping this at the moment. So, I mean, that shows willing from GM. But this is what we want to speak to you about, Peter, is basically where does it stand? Where are we? Because the last I basically think I had my head around it was that Andretti have been approved by the FIA and nothing could really stop them lining up on the grid now, except that FOM could say, well, we're not going to point the cameras at you, and then they don't get any sponsors. So it's a horrible mess. The teams don't look great out of it. The FIA doesn't look great out of it. Sorry, the FOM doesn't look great out of it. FIA look like they're being almost deliberately provocative, and it's all happening out in public. We get to see all their pants drying on the line.
That's one way of putting it, yes. Can I first of all just say that I think you guys have been real supporters of the idea of having a larger grid, something
yeah,
larger definitely. Than 10.
Yeah, yeah.
So quite open about that.
Yeah, 30. Now, hang on. 30-car grid. So I want 15 three-car teams, so 45 cars, days of pre-qualifying. That would get rid of sprint races. I just solved it.
Well, exactly. It would make for a more interesting competition. And that's just exactly what it should be. And it seems that FOM have had this view that, we have our 10 teams, and if you want to come in, you buy a team. Very much in a sort of NFL style, where it's sort of the closed shop, but it will still move around because we have these teams, but they can move and be purchased and do different things. But they seem to have made this decision without really thinking about how competition law works in the EU, which the FIA is very heavily mindful of after its experience of being investigated 20 years ago on this point. So that's why the FIA has turned around and said, absolutely, you can come in, step this way. In fairness, they did go through a process and whittle down from a number of entries down to just the one. And they said, well, this is our criteria and we think you've met this, while a number of other teams or potential teams haven't. And now it's a matter of, and I found it great having the insight from Joe Saywood on this, because he's been very clear at saying what the view is of the teams, and that the view of the teams seems to be that, well, look, there's not enough pie to warrant diluting it from 10 people having a slice of hundreds of millions to it then being 11 people having a slice. But to a certain extent, I don't think they're necessarily viewing the fact, well, what about if you manage to grow said pie by having a US team growing the presence of the sport in such a valuable market? It's also, just to further the NFL analogy for a minute, you look at the size of a sport like that and the commensurate size of the teams. They are way bigger than the Formula One teams in terms of their monetary value, which makes you think the sport has not necessarily peaked yet. I think certainly a lot of those who bought teams a few years ago are now looking and thinking, oh, cash out here and make a great deal. Who wouldn't? But potentially, we don't know exactly where it's going to go. But when you look at the presence of other sports, not to mention the success that the sport is having through Netflix and the way that, in fairness, Liberty has grown the sport in recent years, of which Vegas this weekend is just the latest example. And it'd be interesting to see if actually you could grow that pie and then it won't matter quite so much.
See, now, this is the argument me and Matt have been having. So obviously there's the technical sides of the argument, but there's a real kind of argument to say, is this actually a good faith process? Because there's all these theoretical obstacles in the way, yet there's no definitive FOM rubber stamp. There's no, you know, Liberty or haven't said, yes, oh, fantastic, they got through the FIA process. Phew, that's what we've been waiting on. Come on, come on in, pull up a chair. Let's talk about how much money you get. There's been a kind of united front where Liberty haven't had to do that because they've deployed the teams almost on their behalf. Is that too cynical to say, like, you know, Stroll came out saying it ain't broke, don't fix it. And Christian Horner came out and said, well, you'd need your own engine. And now that they've, you know, basically are saying, well, we'll have our own engine in 2028. What would Horner say to that? Would he move the goalposts or would he go, oh, good point. Oh, no, you're right. I said get an engine and you have. So come on in. Is the process actually in good faith?
But just standing back for a moment, does this not illustrate the problem of having the competitors having such a large say in the governance and operation of the sport?
Massively.
Bingo. Yep, you're right on it. And to me, I don't know, because this is not a new topic for the two of us. We've chatted about it in private before. And to me, I'm just really gobsmacked that FOM and Liberty think they have any real say whatsoever over this process, because the last settlement sort of clearly says that the FIA is the sole regulatory body for the sport, and basically says where you have to sell off your commercial rights to prevent them, to prevent your regulatory powers being used for monopoly purposes. Well, if you have a legitimate team and you don't let them race because you want to make more money by not letting them race, is that not by very definition putting them in danger of an EU investigation?
I'm brilliant. And this is the perfect thing to have Peter on with, because my argument was that the tactic that Liberty would use is say, well, we've been trying to negotiate a commercial deal with them, and gosh darn it, do you know what? We just can't quite come to a satisfactory conclusion. You know, at what point can a court say, well, that's uncompetitive, and actually, you know, mediate or arbitrate on those negotiations? And part two of that question is, why is the EU court so important in an international sport owned by Americans? Are they fair questions?
I know that we're keeping this to a tight half hour today, so I'll try and limit the backstory on that. But the point here is that there was a major investigation into Formula One back in the 1990s, for those of us with long memories. And it took years of investigation, years of instability until, as Matt referenced there, you had the FIA then in effect putting a lease on the commercial rights, which then went to FOM. And it all came down to potentially acting as a cartel and being in breach of EU law.
Can you remind us what happened then? Because I can't remember this from the 90s. What did they do that landed them in hot water? We got time.
Oh, well, in essence, Bernie was using his ability to control. He would write to a track and say, if you want Formula One, you can have Formula One, but only if you don't let these other series race here. And he was doing this, I think, somewhat hysterically. Now I'm going off of memory. Normally, if I knew this was a topic, I'd go back and research and be certain of all my facts. But my memory is the complaint came from someone who owned a truck racing series that I think he either had a competitor series or he wanted to take over the TV rights to it. So in essence, he was making sure they couldn't go to any good tracks and essentially trying to, but then they wound up making some third party deal. And by the time this actually got settled, it wasn't really an issue anymore. But those are in essence the tactics that were being used. And not just there, A1GP, there were numerous complaints about, well, evidence of tactics like this that could be gone back and found should you choose to.
And Peter's a genius because you're going to get sued now. And he completely palmed that off.
But what I love about this is the original report to the FIA was about them wanting to change their own regulations post-Imola. And while that was winding its way through the unbelievably tedious and lengthy bureaucracy, these other complaints showed up and wound up being the basis for the settlement that, as Peter says, saw the FIA having to lease their commercial rights, which also answers the question of, do Liberty own Formula One? No, they lease it from the FIA is exactly what it is.
And indeed, you've then got the FIA solely in there as the regulator. And again, Joe Sayward has given us great history on the issues there and the tensions between the teams and FOM, Liberty wanting to go in a certain direction and then saying, oh, you know, it'd be quite nice if we could just get rid of the FIA and their awkward stewards and administrators, because we don't agree with some of the decisions that they make. Well, let's not relitigate some of the problems that have happened there. But as Matt rightly says, can't really pull that relationship apart due to this precedent and rather painful history that Formula One as a whole has gone through in order to reach the position that it's in now.
That is actually a really valuable insight. I was completely unaware of any of that, I think, because I was probably like 11 at the time. So, but you've gone back, we're the same age, but you've obviously researched your history and you have a legal knowledge of stuff like that. I wasn't implying that Peter was much, much older than me. Ignore the visuals that you're seeing on the screen. We're about the same age. Why is the EU so important in this process?
We are the same age, but I'm afraid this shows what I was doing in my teenage years was reading about FIA. Yeah. Statutes and competition law.
Well, if you want to play like bar pool or beer pong, like I will be better at that. So that's the difference in our 20s, probably. So, why is the EU so important? And if I had to guess, I would guess that Liberty are never going to turn around and just say no, because that would be a disaster. But things can be drawn out. At what point would the EU get involved?
So, this is a slightly more complex issue, because they are talking about the regulatory reach and influence of the European Union. So we've got a lot of the FOM companies are still corporate entities based in London. London is now, of course, in the UK outside of the European Union, but the UK does have a trade and cooperation agreement with the EU. But quite explicitly, that excludes a regulatory reach from the European Union. However, we have teams based in the European Union, notably Ferrari. We have consumers based in the European Union, a couple hundred million people who do like to watch Formula One and are perceived to be a sufficiently important market for races like Las Vegas to be taking place in the middle of the night to make it watchable for an EU market. And we've had start times shifted so that it's not quite so early for EU viewers to have to set their alarm clocks for. So from that point of view, you've then got the sort of collective, the EU looking at that, and therefore the rules that the EU has in relation to that market therefore become more important. You've also got, and I think this is something that sometimes probably are not understood quite so much, is the fact that the European approach to regulation is to do these investigations and to be quite proactive. They will, just on the back of, as Matt was saying there, a complaint will be enough for them to mobilize quite significant resources into investigating, reaching a decision, looking at enforcement. That enforcement can be very, very large, and coming out with fines and measures and saying this is what you'll have to do in order to play in our marketplace, which I know is very, very different from certainly in the US, where, for example, if the federal government wants to regulate something or a federal government agency wants to do something, you very often got to drag that party all the way through court and go through that lovely litigious process that we were talking about earlier on. So I know that this isn't, I suppose, as accessible or understandable an issue when it comes to regulation like that for those in many other countries around the world. But that's why the EU's approach, and that's why, with it being potentially quicker than having to go all the way through court, that's why, again, FOM and the FIA are being a lot more alert to the threat of potentially being in breach of EU law than they might otherwise have been.
But FIA, so with Mohammed bin Salayem as the president, they're clear of all of this because they've said yes. Yeah. So now it is just Liberty Media that is at risk of running into a foul of any competition law. So if we get the feeling that Liberty don't really want Andretti in, and when I say Liberty, that's Liberty and the teams as a, you know, this is speculation for me, Liberty and the teams as a super team of 11 entities are all like, no, and they don't want it. How long can they drag it out before somebody gets involved? Because you've only got to drag this out for a season or two before you're really scuppering them for the next regulation set, for example, and just making it commercially unviable. You keep dragging it out to the point where they just go, do you know what, then I'm not playing. Or do they have enough money to grid up and have Liberty Media not point the cameras at them?
Yeah, and I mean to a certain extent as well, I talked about a disclaimer earlier on. I think the disclaimer here is that we haven't seen a copy of the Concorde Agreement, which is the confidential agreement governing the commercial relationship between the teams and the FOM and in turn the FIA. And we haven't seen that as a confidential document. If you write to the FIA or the teams and say, can I have a look? They tend to reply very nicely and say no, because it's a commercial confidential document. But that governs a lot of the questions we're asking here are governed by what's in that document. And it is currently being renegotiated for another term. So, of course, Andretti are not a part of that. Those negotiations, they'd like to be inside rather than outside. But you make a good point there about negotiations for new Concorde and moving on, the new regulatory settlement, as well as then new rules are always being considered all the time. And unfortunately, they're in this position of being outside. But I think there's also, when we look again at what Formula One is now, you've talked about GM coming in, Chris Medland's story, that's great. We'll have more manufacturers, one of the world's biggest manufacturers coming into F1. We've got Audi coming in, again, from another one of the world's biggest manufacturers. There's a lot of corporate interests here. Those corporate interests would not like to join a sport where there is a potential EU regulatory investigation on the horizon. So I think people are going to want to get this thing settled, certainly in those boardrooms where they're making decisions that are going to be to invest hundreds of millions of dollars and euros every year into a sport. I think you're going to want stability. You're not going to want uncertainty like this in the market. I think at this point, it's actually incredible that GM have dug in and backed Andretti as much as they have. And I think that's a sign of clearly the bond they have with Andretti and also the respect with which Michael and Mario Andretti are held.
And also the fact that Ford is already on board in this sport and they don't want to be left behind as it becomes more popular in the US. We've seen other manufacturers, Mercedes, come in, do very well, capitalizing on their success and participation in Formula One. And GM will not want Ford to have that kind of an advantage. And I think that may be part of the reason that we heard this as Spanners points out, announcement about 2028 that's more of an intention than a done deal at this point. But it is more leverage for them.
Okay, Peter, just to end then, guess. Andretti on the grid, yes or no, and when? Put your fan hat on, take your lawyer hat off. Right, yeah. When are they, when and if and how?
So I'd like to see Andretti on the grid.
That's not the question, Mr. Wright.
Well, let me finish.
I'm badgering the witness.
Even if the argument is, oh, well, they'll be at the back of the grid. Well, let's find out. There's no point saying, oh, well, this is definitely where they'll be. Put them on the grid, let them compete for a period of time. And it's the old argument of, did the French Revolution work? Well, we can't be sure. It's 200 years and it's still going on. You have to let these things play out properly. So, you know, do we want them on the grid? Yes, I'd like to see them on there with GM supplying an original powertrain as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Is it going to happen before 2025? No. And I think a lot would have to happen for that for them to be on the grid in 2025 with a customer engine. So I think we're already at the point where it's looking at 2026 as being the more realistic point. But I want to see them on the grid. I want to see them bringing more drivers on. We need more spots for more young drivers to get into this sport because it's become a closed shop. In terms of the team, that is becoming a closed shop for the drivers.
The sad thing is, if it's this hard for Andretti, which is a massively famous name in Formula One, with a huge engine supplier behind them, that really doesn't make my dream of a 45 car grid with lots of pre-qualifying, doesn't make it seem very viable at all. But thank you very much for your precious time, Peter. I will have the diamond hand delivered for you to add to your Lexus. Go and follow Peter at Digital Law UK still on Twitter, Peter, and we'll get you back on soon. Thank you very much. And hopefully all of you will join us live at midday on Sunday, as we have a very, very strange schedule. I will be up at 3 a.m. to head down to London to Tomo F1's studio, where me and Brad will join them for a live watch along for what I think is a 6 a.m. start in the UK. And then we will be doing our race review at midday on Sunday. And of course, you can catch me on The Ringer with Meg as well later in the afternoon. So until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.